This is Audible.
Tantor Audio presents The Daughter by Jane Shemmelt, narrated by Sophie Aldred.
Part 1. 1. Dorset, 2010. 1 year later. The days grow short. Apples litter the grass, their flesh pockmarked by crows. As I carry logs from the stack under the overhang today, I tread on a soft globe. It collapses into slime under my feet. November. I am cold all the time, but she could be colder. Why should I be comfortable? How could I be? By evening the dog is shivering. The room darkens. I light the fire, and the flames pull me near as the regrets begin to flare, burning and hissing in my head. If only I'd been listening. If only I'd been watching. If only I could start again, exactly 1 year ago. The leather-bound sketchbook Michael gave me is on the table, and in the pocket of the dressing gown there is a bitten red stub of pencil. He told me it would help to draw the past. The pictures are in my head already. A scalpel balanced in trembling fingers, a plastic ballerina twirling round and round, a pile of notes neatly stacked on a bedside table in the dark. I write my daughter's name on the first unmarked page, and underneath I sketch the outline of two black high-heeled shoes lying on their sides, long straps tangled together. Naomi. Bristol, 2009. 1 day before. She was swaying to music on her iPod, so she didn't notice me at first. Her orange scarf was looped round her throat, schoolbooks scattered everywhere. I closed the back door quietly behind me and slid my bag to the floor. It was heavy with notes, my stethoscope, syringes, vials, and boxes. It had been a long day. 2 surgeries, home visits, and paperwork. Leaning against the kitchen door, I watched my daughter, but another girl was in my mind's eye, Jade, lying in a bed with bruises on her arms. That was the chili in my eye. They squirt chili juice into an elephant's eye to distract him while they mend his wounded leg. Theo told me that once. At the time, I didn't believe it could work, but I should have taken it as a warning. It's easier than you think to lose sight of what matters. As I watched Naomi, I imagined painting the curve of her cheeks as she smiled to herself. I would outline them with a paler shade for the light trapped against her skin. With every step, her blonde fringe jumped softly against her forehead. When it lifted, beads of sweat along the hairline glistened. She had pushed up the sleeves of her school jersey. The charm bracelet moved up and down the smooth skin of her arm, almost slipping off. I was glad to see her wearing it. I thought she had lost it years ago.
"Mom, I didn't see you there. What do you think?"
She pulled out her earphones and looked at me. "Wish I could dance like that." I stepped forward and quickly kissed the velvety bloom along her cheek, breathing her in. Lemon soap and sweat. She jerked her head away and bent to pick up her books in a swerving movement that had her quick, glancing grace. Her voice was impatient.
"No, I mean my shoes. Look at them."
They must have been new. Black, very high heels, with straps of leather binding her feet and wrapping tightly round her slim legs. They looked wrong on her. She usually wore pumps in coloured leather, or Converses.
"The heels are incredibly high."
Even I could hear the criticism in my voice, so I tried to laugh.
"Not like your usual. They're not, are they?"
Her voice was triumphant.
"Totally different.
They must have cost the earth. I thought you'd spent your allowance.
They're so comfortable, exactly the right size."
As if she couldn't believe her luck.
"You can't wear them to go out, darling. They look far too tight on you." "Admit you're jealous. You want them."
She smiled a little half-smile that I hadn't seen before. "Naomi,
Well, you can't have them. I'm in love with them. I love them almost as much as I love Bertie.
While she was speaking, she stretched down to stroke the dog's head. She turned then, and yawning widely, went slowly upstairs, her shoes hitting each step with a harsh metallic noise, like little hammers. She'd escaped. My question hung unanswered in the warm air of the kitchen. I poured myself a glass of Ted's wine. Naomi didn't usually answer back or walk out while I was talking. I stashed the doctor's bag and notes in the corner of the cloakroom, then, sipping my drink, started walking around the kitchen, straightening towels. She used to tell me everything. As I hung up her coat, the sharpness of the alcohol began to clear my mind. It was part of the bargain, and I'd weighed it all up long ago. It was simple. I did the job I loved and earned good money, but it meant I was home less than some mothers. The bonus was that it gave the children space. They were growing up independently, which was what we'd always wanted. I pulled the potatoes out of the cupboard. They were covered in little lumps of soil, so I rinsed them quickly under the tap. Thinking about it, though, she hadn't wanted to talk properly for months now. Ted would tell me not to worry. "She's a teenager," he would say, "growing up." The cold water chilled my hands, and I turned off the tap. Growing up or growing away? Preoccupied or withdrawn? The questions hummed in my mind as I hunted in the drawer for the potato peeler. Last summer in my surgery, I had seen an anxious adolescent. She had carefully sliced the delicate skin of her wrists into multiple red lines. I shook my head to drive the image away. Naomi wasn't depressed. There was that new smile to set against the impatience. Her involvement in the play against the silences at home. If she seemed preoccupied, it was because she was older now, more thoughtful. Acting had given her maturity. Last summer she'd worked with Ted in his lab, and she'd become interested in medicine. As I began peeling potatoes, it occurred to me that her newfound confidence could be a key to success in interviews. Perhaps I should celebrate. The starring role in the school play would also increase her chances of getting a place at medical school. Interviewers liked students with outside interests. It was known to offset the stress of becoming a doctor. Painting worked like that for me, dissolving the stress of general practice. With the tap back on, the brown mud swirled around and around in the sink and then disappeared. I'd almost finished Naomi's portrait, and I could feel the pull of it now. Whenever I painted, I was in a different world. Worries melted away. My easel was just upstairs in the attic, and I wished I could escape more often. I dumped the potato peelings in the bin and took the sausages out of the fridge. Theo's favourite had been bangers and mash since he was a toddler. I could talk to Naomi tomorrow. Later, Ted phoned to say he was held up at the hospital. The twins came back home ravenously hungry. Ed lifted his hand in silent greeting as he took a heaped plate of toast upstairs. I could hear the bedroom door close behind him and pictured him turning on music, falling onto his bed, toast in hand, eyes closed. I remembered that about being 17, hoping no one would bang on your door, or worse, walk in and talk to you. Theo, freckles blazing in his pale face, shouted out the day's triumphs as he crunched biscuits, one after another, emptying the tin. Naomi came back through the kitchen, her wet hair lying in thick points on her neck. I hurriedly pushed sandwiches into her rucksack as she was on her way out, then stood at the open door for a few minutes, listening to her footsteps going slowly down the road, gradually becoming fainter. The school theatre was a street away, but she was always late. She'd stopped running everywhere now. The play was sapping her energy. Though just 15, Naomi Malcolm's Maria is mature beyond her years. Naomi mixes innocence and sexuality in a bewitching performance as Maria, a star is born. Being tired and wound up was worth it for those reviews on the school website. Two more performances after this, Thursday, then Friday. Soon, we would all get back to normal. Dorset, 2010. 1 year later. I know it's Friday today, because the fish lady comes to the cottage. I crouch down under the stairs as her van draws up outside, the white shape smudged by the old glass of the door. The woman rings the bell and waits, a squat, hopeful figure, head bobbing as she searches the windows. If she sees me, I will have to open the door, compose words, smile. None of these are possible today. A small spider scrabbles over my hand. Bending my head further, I breathe dust from the carpet, and after a while the van rumbles away down the lane. It's a day for being on my own. I lie low and wait for the hours to pass. Fridays still hurt. After a while, I get up and find the book I left on the hearth last night. I turn over the page with the picture of her shoes, and on the next one, draw the little overlapping circles of a silver ring. Bristol, 2009. The night of the disappearance. I knelt on the kitchen floor, opening up my medical bag to check the drugs against a list to see what I needed. This job was easier away from the surgery. There were fewer interruptions if I picked my time. I was groping into the depths of the leather pockets, so I didn't notice her come silently into the kitchen. She walked past me, and the bag she was carrying knocked against my shoulder. I looked up, keeping a finger on my list. I was running low on paracetamol and pethidine. Naomi glanced down at me, her blue eyes clouded with thought. Even through the thick makeup she'd already put on for the play, there were dark lines under her eyes. She looked exhausted. This wasn't the moment to ask the questions I'd wanted to. "You're almost done, sweetie. This is the second last performance," I said brightly. Clothes were spilling from her carrier bag. The heels of her shoes had made little holes in the plastic. "Dad and I will be there tomorrow." I sat back on my heels and looked up, studying her face. The black eyeliner made her look much older than 15. "I'm longing to see if it's changed since the first night." She looked at me blankly, and then gave me the new smile. Only one side of her mouth lifted, so it looked as if she was smiling to herself. "What time will you be back?" I gave up, and got to my feet reluctantly. I never managed to finish anything. "It's Thursday. Dad usually picks you up on Thursdays." "I told him not to bother ages ago. Walking with friends is easier." She sounded bored. "The meal will finish around midnight. Shan will give me a lift." "Midnight?" But she was tired already. Despite myself, my voice was rising. "You've got the play again tomorrow, the party straight after. It's only a meal. 10:30. "That's not nearly long enough. Why do I always have to be different from everyone else?" Her fingers started tapping the table. The little ring that some boy at school had given her was glinting in the light. 11, then. She stared at me. "I'm not a baby!" The anger in her tone was surprising. We couldn't argue all night. She would be on stage soon and needed to calm down. I had to finish sorting the medicines before cooking supper. 11:30, not a second later. She shrugged and turned, bending over Bertie where he lay at full stretch, sleeping against the stove. She kissed him, pulling his soft ears gently. Though he hardly stirred, his tail thumped the floor. I touched her arm. "His old sweetheart. He needs his sleep." She jerked her arm from my hand, her face tense. "Relax, it's okay. You're a triumph, remember?" I gave her a quick hug, but she turned her face away. "Only one more day to go." Her mobile went off and she stepped back, her hand resting on the draining board as she answered. Her fingers were long. She had freckles, tiny ones, that went as far as the second knuckle, light gold, like grains of demerara sugar. The nails were bitten like a child's, at odds with the pretty ring. I folded her hand in both of mine and kissed it quickly. She was talking to Nikita. I don't think she even noticed. She was still young enough for the knuckles to feel like little pits under my lips. The phone call finished and she turned to go, a little wave at the door,
her way of making up for being irritable. "Bye, Mum," she said. Later, I fell asleep by mistake. I put the kettle on for her hot water bottle at about 11 and lay down on the sofa to wait. I must have drifted off almost immediately. When I woke up, my neck ached and my mouth tasted stale. I got up and, pulling my jersey down, went to put the kettle on again. The kettle was cold under my hand. I looked at the clock. 2 in the morning. I hadn't heard her come in. I felt sick. She'd never been as late as this. What had happened? The blood thumped painfully in my ears for a second until common sense took over. Of course, she had let herself in by the front door and gone straight up to bed. Asleep in the basement kitchen a flight below, I wouldn't have heard the door shutting behind her. She must have dropped her shoes soundlessly in the front porch and then tiptoed upstairs, quietly, guiltily, past our room and up to hers on the second floor. I stretched as I waited for the kettle to boil. She could still have her hot water bottle. I would wrap it up and tuck it in beside her. She might sleepily register the warmth. I went upstairs slowly past the boys' rooms. Ed snored suddenly as I passed, making me jump. Up another flight to Naomi's room. The door was open a crack, and I went in quietly. It was pitch dark and stuffy, smelling of strawberry shampoo and something else, bitter with citrus at the back of it. I felt my way to her chest of drawers, and pulling out a shirt, slipped the hot water bottle inside. I stepped carefully over to the bed, half tripping on strewn clothes. My hands moved to turn the cover back around her, but it was smooth and flat. The bed was empty. I snapped on the light. Tights spilt from open drawers. There were towels and shoes on the floor. A thong lay on top of a red lacy bra on her bedside table, a black half-cup bra on the chair. I didn't recognize any of these things. Had her friends changed here too? Naomi was usually so tidy. A bottle of foundation had tipped over on the dressing table. A stick of lipstick lay in the small beige puddle. Her grey school jersey had been left on the floor, with a white shirt still inside it. The cover of the bed was slightly dented where she had sat on it, but the pillow was quite smooth. Fear curled in the pit of my stomach. I put my hand on the wall, and its coldness seemed to travel up my arm to the inside of my chest. And then I heard the front door shut 2 floors down. Thank God. Thank you, God. I put the hot water bottle under the duvet, far enough down to make a warm place for her feet. They would be cold by now in those thin shoes. Then I ran downstairs, careless of the noise. I wouldn't be cross, not tonight. I would kiss her, take her coat, and send her up. I could be cross tomorrow. My footsteps slowed as I rounded the corner of the stairs, and Ted came into view. Ted, not Naomi. He stood looking up at me. He was wearing his coat and his briefcase was by his feet. "She's not back!" I was out of breath. The words were difficult to push out. "I thought you were her, coming in!" "What?" He looked exhausted. His shoulders were hunched. There were deep circles under his eyes. "Naomi hasn't come home yet." I went close to him. A faint smell of burning clung about him. It must have been from the diathermy, spluttering heat, sealing cut blood vessels. He'd come straight from the operating theatre. His eyes, the same sea blue as Naomi's, looked puzzled. "Her play ended at 9:30, didn't it?" An expression of panic crossed his face. "Jesus, it's Thursday!" He'd forgotten that she had cancelled Thursday pickups, but he never knew what was happening in the children's lives anyway. He never asked. I felt the slow swell of anger. "She walks back with friends now, she told you." "Of course she did. I'd forgotten. Oh well." He looked relieved. "But tonight was different." How could he be so relaxed when my heart was pounding with anxiety? "She went out for a meal with the cast." "I can't keep up," he shrugged. "So she's out with her mates. Perhaps they're having such a good time they stayed on." "Ted, it's after 2! My face flushed hot with panic and fury. Surely he realized this was different, that it felt wrong. "That late? Gosh, I'm sorry." The operation went on and on and on. I hoped you'd be asleep by now. He spread his hands in apology.
Where the hell is she?
I stared at him, my voice rising.
She never does this. She lets me know even if she's 5 minutes late.
As I said it, it occurred to me that she hadn't for a long time now. But then she had never been as late as this.
There's a rapist in Bristol. It's said on the news.
Calm down, Jen. Who is she with exactly? He looked down at me, and I could sense reluctance. He didn't want this to be happening. He wanted to go to bed.
Her friends from the play, Nikita, everyone. It was just a meal, not a party.
Perhaps they went to a club after.
She'd never get in.
Her cheeks were still rounded. She had a 15-year-old face, younger sometimes, especially when she was tired. She's not old enough.
It's what they all do.
Ted's voice was slow with tiredness. He leant his tall frame against the wall in the hall.
They have false IDs. Remember when Theo... Not Naomi.
Then I remembered the shoes, the smile. Was it possible? A club?
Let's give it a bit longer.
Ted's voice was calm.
I mean, it's kind of normal. Still early if you're having fun. Let's wait until 2:30.
Then what?
She'll probably be back.
He pushed himself away from the wall, and rubbing his face with his hands, he began to walk towards the steps at the end of the hall that led down to the kitchen.
If not, we'll phone Shan. You phoned Naomi, obviously.
I hadn't. God knows why. I hadn't even checked for a text. I felt for my mobile phone, but it wasn't in my pocket.
Where the bloody hell's my bloody phone?
I pushed past Ted and ran downstairs. It must have fallen out and was half hidden under a squashed cushion on the sofa. I snatched it up. No text. I punched her number.
Hiya, this is Naomi. Sorry, I'm busy doing something incredibly important right now, but leave me a number and I'll get back to you. That's a promise. Bye!
I shook my head, unable to speak. I need a drink. Ted went slowly to the drinks cupboard. He poured two whiskies and held one out to me. I felt the alcohol burn my throat, then travel down the length of my gullet. 2:15. 15 minutes to go before we would ring Shan. I didn't want to wait. I wanted to leave the house. I wanted to go down the road to the school theatre, wrench open the doors and shout her name into the dusty air. If she wasn't there, then I would run down the main street, past the university, storm into all the clubs, pushing past the bouncers, and yell into the crowds of dancers.
Is there any food?
What?
Jenny, I've been operating all night. I missed supper in the canteen. Is there any food? I opened the fridge and looked in. I couldn't recognize anything. Squares and oblongs. My hands found cheese and butter. The cold lumps of butter tore the bread. Ted silently took it from me. He made a perfect sandwich and cut off the crusts. While he was eating, I found Nikita's number on a pink post-it note stuck to the corkboard on the cupboard. She didn't pick up either. The phone was in her bag. She had pushed it under the table so she could dance in the club they'd managed to get into. Everyone else wanted to go home. All their friends were leaning against the wall, yawning. But Naomi and Nikita were dancing together, having fun. No one would be able to hear Nikita's phone ringing in the bag under the table. Shan must be awake too, waiting. It was only a year since her divorce from Neil. This would feel worse on her own. 2:30. I phoned Shan, and as I waited, I remembered her telling me a week ago how Nikita still shared everything with her, and the stabbing moment of jealousy that I'd felt. Naomi didn't do that anymore. Now I was glad Nikita still confided in her mother. Shan would know exactly where we could pick them up. A sleepy voice mumbled an answer. She must have fallen asleep like me.
Hello, Shan.
I tried to make my voice sound normal.
I'm so sorry to wake you. Do you have any idea where they are? We'll pick them up, but the trouble is...
I paused and attempted to laugh. Naomi forgot to tell me where they'd be.
Wait a moment. I could see her sitting up, running her hand through her hair, blinking at the alarm clock on her bedside table. Say all that again? I took a breath and tried to speak slowly. Naomi's not back yet. They must have gone on somewhere after the meal. Did Nikita say where?
The meal's tomorrow, Jen.
No, that's the party.
Both tomorrow.
Nikita's here. She's exhausted. She's been asleep since I picked her up hours ago.
I repeated stupidly.
Hours ago? I collected her straight after the play.
There was a little pause, and then she said quietly, there was no meal.
But Naomi said,
my mouth was dry,
she took her new shoes. She said,
I sounded like children do when they want something they can't have. She had taken the shoes and the bag of clothes.
How could there not have been a meal?
Shan must be mistaken. Perhaps Nikita hadn't been invited. There was a longer pause.
I'll check with Nikita, she said. Phone you back in a moment.
I was outside a gate that had just shut with a little click. Behind it was a place where children slept safely, their limbs trustingly spread across the sheets, a place where you didn't phone a friend at 2:30 in the morning. The kitchen chairs were cold and hard. Ted's face was white. He kept bending his knuckles till they cracked. I wanted to stop him, but I couldn't open my mouth in case I started screaming. I picked the phone up quickly when it rang, and at first I didn't say anything.
There was no meal, Jenny.
Shan's voice was slightly breathless.
Everyone went home. I'm sorry.
A faint buzzing noise started in my head, filling in the silence that stretched after her words. I felt giddy, as if I was tipping forwards or the world was tipping back. I held tightly to the edge of the table.
Can I speak to Nikita?
By the tiny space that followed my question, I could measure how far away I had travelled from the gate that had clicked behind me. Shan sounded hesitant.
She's gone back to sleep.
Asleep? How could that matter? Nikita was there, safe. We had no idea where our daughter was. A wave of anger was breaking on top of my fear.
If Nikita knows anything, anything at all that we don't, and Naomi might be in danger.
My throat constricted. Ted took the phone from me. Hi there, Shanya. There was a pause. I appreciate how difficult this will be for Nikita. His voice was calm, but with an edge of authority. It was exactly how he talked to the junior doctors on his team if they rang him for advice about a neurosurgical problem. If Naomi doesn't come home soon, we may need to call the police. The more information you give us... Another pause. Thanks. Yes. See you in a few minutes, then. The boys were sleeping in their rooms. I leant into the warm, breathing space around their heads. Theo had burrowed under the duvet. His hair, sticking up in a ruff above its edge, was stiff under my lips. Ed's black fringe was damp. Even in sleep, his eyebrows swooped down like the wings of a blackbird. As I straightened, I caught my reflection in his mirror. My face, lit by the street lamp shining through the window, looked as if it belonged to someone much older. My hair was dark and shapeless. I dragged Ed's brush through it. As we drove past the school theatre, Ted stopped the car and we got out.
I don't know why. I still don't know why we had to check. Did we really think you would be there, curled up and sleeping on the stage? That we could wake you, and that you would smile and stretch, sleepy and stiff, with some explanation about taking too long to change, that we would put our arms round you and take you home.
The glass doors were locked. They rocked slightly as I pulled at the handles. There was a nightlight in the foyer,
and the bottles in the bar were shining in neat rows. A torn red and yellow program lay on the floor just inside the door. I could make out red letters spelling West and Story on different lines, and part of a picture of a girl with a blue swirling skirt. Ted drove carefully, though I knew he was tired. He had pressed the button on the dashboard that made the back of my seat warm up. It made me sweat, and nausea seemed to rise from the deep leather upholstery. I glanced at him. He was good at this. Good at looking serious, not desperate. When Naomi was in difficulty during her birth, his calmness had stopped me panicking. He had organized the epidural for the cesarean section, and he was there when they lifted out her small, blooded body. I wouldn't think about that now. I looked out of the window quickly. The streets were shining and empty. A fine rain had started to mist the windows. What had she been wearing? I couldn't remember. Her mac? What about her scarf? I looked up into the roadside trees, as if the orange cloth might be there, tangled in the wet black branches. At Shania's house, Ted knocked firmly. The night was silent and still around us, but if anyone had been passing in a car, they would have seen a couple like any other. We were wearing warm coats and clean shoes as we waited quietly, heads bowed in the rain. We probably looked normal. Shania's face was prepared. She looked calm and serious as she hugged us. It was hot in her house, the gas fire flaming in her tidy sitting room. Nikita was hunched on the sofa, a cushion held tightly to her, her long legs in rabbit-pattern pajamas tucked beneath her. I smiled at her, but my mouth felt stiff and trembled at the corners. Shan sat close to her on the sofa. We sat opposite, and Ted took my hand. Ted and Jenny want to ask you about Naomi now, babe. Shania put her arm round Nikita, who looked down as she twisted a thick lock of her dark hair in her fingers. I moved to sit by her on the other side, but she shifted slightly away from me. I tried to make my voice gentle. Where is she, Nick?
I don't know.
She bent and pushed her head into the cushion. Her voice was muffled.
I don't know, I don't know, I don't know.
Shania's eyes met mine over her head. I'll start then, Shan said. I'll tell Jenny what you told me. Nikita nodded. Her mother continued. Naomi told Nikita that she was going to meet someone, a bloke, after the play.
A bloke?
Ted's voice cut across my intake of breath.
What bloke?
The word in his mouth sounded dangerous. Not a boy, older. My heart started banging so loudly, I was afraid Nikita would hear and refuse to tell us anything.
She said, Nikita hesitatingly began, she said she had met someone. He was hot.
I uncrossed my legs and turned round to face her properly.
Hot? Naomi said that? That's all right, isn't it? You asked me.
Nikita's forehead puckered, her eyes filled with tears.
Of course, I told her.
But it wasn't all right.
I'd never heard her use that word. We had talked about sex, but as I desperately scanned my memory for clues, I couldn't remember when. Relationships, sex, and contraception? Naomi didn't seem interested. Had she been? What had I missed?
Was he... did she...
I groped in a forest of possibilities. Was he from school? Nikita shook her head. Ted spoke then, lightly, casually, as though it wasn't important.
This guy. She must have met him before.
Nikita's shoulders dropped fractionally. She stopped twisting her hair. Ted's calmness was working, but I felt a stab of anger that he could manage it so easily. I could hardly keep my voice from trembling.
Yeah. I think he was around in the theatre sometimes,
she glanced down.
You know, at the back.
At the back?
Again, barely inquisitive.
Yeah, Where people waited, maybe.
She looked up and there was reluctance in her dark eyes.
I didn't really see.
What did he look like? I asked quickly.
Don't know.
Nikita didn't look at me. There was a pause.
Maybe dark hair?
She moved nearer Shan on the sofa and closed her eyes. I didn't think she would tell us anything else, but Ted was asking another question. And tonight? What did she say to you about tonight? There was silence. Nikita was completely still. Then Shan stood up. She's tired now. Her voice was firm. She needs to go back to bed.
Tell us, Nikita. Please.
I touched her on the arm lightly, carefully.
Please, please tell us what she said.
She looked back at me then, her brown eyes wide with surprise. Her best friend's mother was a busy figure in the distance, cheerful, running in and running out, in charge of her life and her family. She didn't plead.
She said, Nikita paused for a fraction. She said, wish me luck.
2. Dorset, 2010. 1 year later. Autumn deepens into winter. In the morning, the silence presses coldly against my face. I listen, though I'm not sure what I'm listening for. By now, I should have learnt the absence of the sounds that I took for granted. The muted steps of bare feet, the distant kettle, murmuring radio voices, and the porcelain chink of the coffee cups on the edge of the bath. The noises one person makes are quiet, careful, separated out. They ebb into silence. I open the window, and the softly crashing breath of the sea comes into the room like something alive. I touch her bedroom door as I pass. She chose this room when she was small. It was never really her bedroom, because until the past few months, it had just been our holiday home, but we'd all thought of that room as hers. As a child, she liked to pretend the little round window under the thatch was a porthole and that her bed was a boat. The police took the mattress away and all the bedding. The wood of the door is cold and damp under my fingertips. Ted washed the blood off the floor. I haven't been inside since I arrived. The wavering reflection of the window frame fractures around my hands as I lie in the bathwater. When the bell rings, I get out quickly, a towel round me, then my dressing gown. At the top of the stairs, my steps freeze. I can see a man in uniform through the glass of the front door. My heart goes so fast I feel faint and I hold the banisters. This could be the moment they've come to tell me they have found something in the mud of a field. The heel of a shoe, perhaps, soft and rotten. The gleam of a silver charm. The white of a tooth. There is nothing they can tell me that I haven't thought of. But I stop, as if I've been shot. Then I see red somewhere on his jacket, a bulky bag. Someone with a special delivery. When I open the door, he hands me the post. The order of small paintbrushes from the art shop in Bristol. On the mat already is a postcard of a Welsh mountain from Ted's vast collection. His way of keeping in touch. No message, as usual. I sit at the kitchen table, and my heart slows. The sketchbook is in front of me. I pull it towards me and open it at the next page. When the police came to the door, and I saw the black and white, the padded jackets and the badges, her absence became official. It was still dark, but it must have been towards morning, maybe 4 or 5 a.m. The pencil is rough in my fingers. I can feel the chips where it's been bitten, as I draw a little hooded top, shading between the folds with short grey lines. Bristol, 2009. The night of the disappearance. The policeman at the door was in his mid-50s, his colourless eyes sunk in soft pouches of flesh. Whatever natural expression he had was overlain by a veneer of professional calm, though his eyes, moving quickly over my face, betrayed his unease,
Behind him was a small woman, brown hair in a tight French pleat, immaculate red lipstick. I thought I could see anger tamped down. Perhaps she'd had to get up specially, put on the crisp uniform and the thick makeup.
Dr. Malcolm?
The man's voice was carefully neutral. At home, I didn't call myself doctor. I was the children's mother, my husband's wife. But if this policeman thought I was a fellow professional, he might try even harder.
Yes.
I stood back to let them in.
I'm Police Constable Steve Wareham, and this is Police Constable Sue Dunning.
He took off his hat. There was a little ridge running round his thin grey hair. He shook my hand and spoke quietly. He was sorry for us, but not the sort of sorry I was afraid of. I'd been afraid he would say sorry for your loss. The woman was brisker. She nodded, but put her hands behind her back as if she didn't want to touch me. I was the kind of woman whose child doesn't come back home. I took them to the kitchen. We had just returned from Shan's house, and I needed to watch the clock. It was over 4 hours since Naomi should have been back, and I wanted to tell them immediately about the man whose shadow seemed thrown against the bright walls of the kitchen. In my mind, I was screaming at them to hurry. Leave now, you might catch them. He is driving with her down a long street in the rain. He's going into a house. He's locking the door. He's turning round to face her. She is crying. Oh, no, of course not. She never cries. Hurry! Ted began talking. He started from the beginning, which was what they wanted. They wanted everything, and it took an hour. They asked for her laptop, then her birth certificate and passport. They tried the mobile phone again, but there wasn't an answering message or even a ringtone this time. Out of charge. Naomi's phone was often dead. It didn't mean anything. When Steve Wareham told me they could have traced the location of the phone if it had been charged, I fought back a surge of helpless anger and fear. I gave them her school photo from last term. I stared at it for a few seconds. It had been taken only a few months ago, but she looked so much younger. It was as though I was looking at another person with a wide smile, her bright hair pulled back in a ponytail, her face shining. I thought of the foundation pooling around the little bottle. She hadn't looked like that child in the photo before the play. Did she have hobbies? Maybe. I didn't know. I was at work all day. I couldn't know everything. The constable raised an eyebrow briefly. What school? What doctor? What dentist? Dentist? What? Dental records? The brief spasm of pain on Ted's face showed he had got there too. School friends? Names? Boyfriends? Not a boyfriend, no. Someone who waited at the back of the theatre. He had dark hair and she thought he was hot. He's got her. He could be hurting her at this very moment, his hands tight round her neck. Perhaps he's forcing her down on the ground, pulling off her clothes, pushing her under him, the side of her hand in her mouth to stifle her. I pushed my fingers hard into my own mouth, biting them to stop myself screaming. They wrote everything down. Police Constable Sue Dunning gave me a missing person form to fill in. She said it was too soon to call it an abduction, no evidence as such. My hands were shaking, so I wrote slowly. They kept talking to me, asking questions. Height? About 5'5". Weight? 8 stone. Yes, she was slim. No, not anorexic. Just one of those people always on the go. She ate plenty.
Are you hungry? You didn't have supper, did you? I didn't mind about that then, because I thought you were going out for a meal. Oh, you should have told me. I could have made you something.
What was she wearing when I last saw her? She was coming downstairs with her bag, and I think she was wearing a mac, or was it her school coat? Perhaps her little grey hoodie. Let me think. I can check in her wardrobe and let you know.
I hope it was a mac. It's raining. You'll get wet.
She was going to change into a dress for after... And new shoes. They were black, with straps. High heels. Different.
They may have been a present, do you think? A trick? A bribe? She was wearing a charm bracelet. That might be important. The bag she was carrying had little holes in it. I don't know. Tesco? Waitrose?
Don't try to run in those shoes. You'll break your ankles. Take them off, and then run.
Were there problems at home? Had she gone missing before? Had she ever tried to harm herself?
The questions were relentless. I was exhausted. They hadn't understood anything. She was in the play. She was tired, of course, tetchy sometimes, but underneath she was fine. And all the time I was listening for her footsteps. She might walk in at any moment, an excuse ready-made, amazed at the fuss. All this would fade into a nightmare.
Steve Wareham was still speaking.
Before we go any further, we need to search the premises.
I stared at him. Didn't he believe anything we had said?
What?
Ted's voice was incredulous. Now?
You'd be surprised.
He didn't mean to sound patronising.
You wouldn't believe the number of missing children we find still at home. Kids hiding in the wardrobe. Making a point.
They looked upstairs, Ted showing the way. They went into the loft, the cupboards, and the wardrobes. They were methodical and quiet, leaving the boys to sleep on, undisturbed. They looked in the garden shed and the wheelie bins. I waited in the kitchen, my hand resting on the phone. When they had finished, they looked tired.
Someone from the force will come back later.
Sue Dunning was faintly embarrassed.
You will have to be eliminated from the inquiry. Routine measures.
She didn't need to be embarrassed. They were being thorough. That meant they would find her. Ted asked what would happen next, and she reeled off a list. File the report, contact the school and the theatre, visit Nikita for witness statements, look at Facebook, examine her laptop and the mobiles of her friends for texts, interview the teachers, go to the clubs, pubs, restaurants, garages, railway stations, seaports, airports, Interpol. And if she's not back in 24 hours, get the media involved.
Airports? Media?
Ted put his arm round me.
One final thing. We'll need her toothbrush,
Steve Wareham said quietly.
In case.
The pink toothbrush looked oddly childish in the yellow plastic mug in her bathroom. Sue Dunning slipped it into a little plastic envelope, and it wasn't hers anymore. It was DNA from a missing person. In case.
Thank you for your cooperation.
Steve Wareham stood up stiffly, hand in the small of his back. The lines on his face looked deeper. I wondered what it must feel like to face parents like us, and for a fleeting moment I felt sorry for him.
We will fully inform the day shift, which starts at 7 a.m. There will be a meeting with the senior manager of the Criminal Investigation Department. Not, of course, that we know there is any criminal activity involved at the present time.
He took a breath and continued.
In the meantime, it would help us if you searched for clues here in your house, in case there's anything you might have overlooked. Go through everything that's happened in the last few days and weeks. Anything that seemed different about your daughter. Write it down and tell us. I'll take the laptop away with us for now.
He smiled at us as he picked it up, and his face became gentler.
Michael Copier will be in contact. He's the family liaison officer for this area. He'll be round in a couple of hours.
A couple of hours. What about the next 5 minutes? And the 5 minutes after that? They have a picture. It'll help. But it doesn't show the way her hair shines so brightly. It looks like sheets of gold. She has a tiny mole just beneath her left eyebrow. She smells very faintly of lemons. She bites her nails. She never cries. Find her.
Part 2. 3. Dorset, 2010. 1 year later.
The faint morning bustle that washes up the lane from the village has faded. The morning sinks into a dull afternoon, and unannounced, grief settles closely around me. It will pass as long as I stand quite still. On home visits in the past, I could tell from the door if patients were sick by how still they lay. Appendicitis, a ruptured abdominal aorta, meningitis, the muscles become rigid to shield the unfolding disaster. In the summer, I lay motionless as the hours dissolved, watching the dust dance in glittering columns as the sunlight slid through each window in turn. I wanted to die. But I knew then, as I do now, that one day I might look up and she could be there, framed in the doorway. And of course, I would never abandon the boys. Besides, her dog sleeps in my kitchen. On cue, Bertie yawns, climbs out of his basket, and wags his tail. His opaque eyes track me as I cross the kitchen. His neck is warm under my fingers when I clip on the lead. The deep fur has toughened with age. I shove the notebook and pencil into a pocket. The back door of the kitchen opens into the garden, which leads onto fields. Mother gave me the cottage before she died. It was lucky that she did. It gave me somewhere to hide. Lucky. Good luck. This is my lucky day. Wish me luck. A trivial word to describe the weight of those swings of fate that open or close against you, like great doors banging in the wind. Naomi never thought she would need luck. She thought she had been born lucky. I thought she had been too. I thought we all had been. Only a year ago, I thought we had everything. It's hard to see exactly where it began to change. I go back, over and over again, to different points in time, to work out where I could have altered fate. I could pick almost any moment in my life and twist it to a different shape. If I hadn't decided to become a doctor, if Ted hadn't taken the books out of my arms in the library years ago, if I hadn't been rushing that afternoon in my surgery, if I'd had more time. Time was running out, but I didn't know it then. I climb the cliff path, waiting as Bertie jumps stiffly up the ledges of grey rock. At the top, the wind blows spray against my mouth like rain. It seeps between my lips, salty, more like tears than rain. My mind goes to the afternoon in my doctor life when the clock started ticking down the hours of Naomi's last days with us. The afternoon I saw Jade, the chilli in my eye. Sitting on a bench, the sea and sky stretching in front of me, I pull the sketchbook from my pocket and begin to draw a toy giraffe, smudging the coat and making the edge of one ear ragged. Bertie settles to wait, his head on my feet, whining softly from time to time. On the 2nd of November a year ago, I had no way of knowing that we only had 17 days left. Bristol, 2009. 17 days before. It had been raining all day. Patients were coming in off the narrow street with dripping clothes and wet hair, letting in the swish and rumble of the main road at the end of our little cul-de-sac. Our practice was near the docks, set back a little between a pine furniture shop and a rubbish-strewn car park where the weeds grew high and thin through patches of broken tarmac. The streets nearby were dense with small Victorian terrace houses. When I drove to work, nudging the car through the narrowing streets, I would glimpse the dark water of the docks between old warehouses. The practice was popular, or perhaps just convenient. The small waiting room was always crammed with patients, though the few minutes we had for each never seemed enough. In the allotted 7 minutes, it was almost impossible to give people what they wanted. All the same, I thought they knew we were on their side. At least, I thought so until that afternoon. I remember quite a lot. In particular, I remember the smell. By late afternoon, my room smelt bad. Sweat, blood, and stale alcohol. Flesh took on a greenish colour in the harsh overhead light.
The blinds were drawn over the window to keep out the street, and in here it was as though that world didn't exist. It was hot. Toys were scattered over the floor. The basin in the corner was full of bloody metal, covered over with blue paper towels. I was tired. Mrs. Bartlett's examination had been difficult. It had been hard to see the cervical polyp for the bleeding, and she would need referral to a clinic tomorrow. I glanced at the list on my screen, and as I cleared the basin, then washed my hands, I thought about the next patient. A temporary resident, Joska Jones. Polish? I yawned into the little mirror above the sink. My hair had escaped the clasp and was wildly curling around my face. My mascara had smudged again. I narrowed my eyes at my reflection, hoping his problem would be straightforward so I could make up time. I called him in. Mid-twenties, high cheekbones, tanned skin. It took a second to see he wasn't ill. I could sort this quickly. How can I help? Back pain, runs in the family. A Welsh accent. His hand, strong and weathered, lay close to mine on the table. I put my hands in my lap. What do you think brought this on? Carrying my kid sister around. A defensive note crept into his voice. She likes to sit on my shoulders, but she's getting heavy. Carrying children doesn't help. It's tempting, though. I used to carry Naomi everywhere, long after she could walk on her own. I like the weight of her, her face against mine. Best to let her walk on her own. I caught a flicker of anger in his eyes, but in 7 minutes, advice was more important than sympathy, and I had to look at his back. The long, erector spiny muscles either side of his spine were as smooth and thick as a pair of snakes, but when he lay on his back, he winced as I raised his legs. Sciatica. His reflexes and sensation were normal. When I told him what exercises he needed to do and prescribed some analgesia, he smiled and shook my hand. The laying on of hands had worked its magic. His hostility evaporated completely. He left with a leaflet of advice and his script, his foot accidentally tipping a toy as he went. It spun across the room and crashed into the wall. I picked it up as the door closed. It was the little plastic duck with the faded orange beak that had been chewed so often it was frayed into soft spikes, and the wing had come cleanly off, leaving a sharp edge. There was a muffled clang as it hit the bottom of the metal bin. I called the next patient in. I knew Jade was 10, though she looked much younger. She stood motionless as her mother took off her anorak, her school jersey, her skirt. There were bruises on her face, her arms and her legs. She seemed perfect apart from the bruises, but her pretty face was blank. She watched me closely as she clutched a tattered velvet giraffe. I had seen her at least 4 times this year. There had been tiredness, ill-defined abdominal pain, poor appetite, and now coughing. Nothing had jumped out at me before, though I had noticed her dirty clothes and the matted hair that hung in silvery ropes. I had simply given advice and tried to reassure her anxious mother. This time it was different. The bruises were new. I smiled at Jade, but the room seemed to turn darker around her. Her mother, in bulging fake fur, talked quickly and loudly, leaving no gaps between her words. Gaps held clues, but her words fell out in a tight line.
Still keeping us awake with the bloody coughing?
The woman's hard green eyes tracked mine.
Something else as well.
The caked face pushed in close, and little blobs of hardened mascara trembled when she blinked. Her fingers gripped her daughter's shoulders tightly.
She comes home covered in bruises. She says she trips over a lot. We think it's the other kids, picking on her.
Why are they doing that?
I don't know, do I?
I uncurled Jade's fingers and put the steel disc of my stethoscope into the small palm so its coldness on her chest wouldn't shock her. Can I listen to your tummy? The bright head made a small movement up and down. I put my stethoscope on top of her vest, first to gain her confidence. Her hair fell over my hand,
and I saw something black scuttle up a strand towards her scalp. When she stopped holding her breath, I lifted the vest to listen and saw that the bumpy little ribcage was bruised. There were more on her backbone. I could hear the mother's voice become louder and faster as she watched me, but I stopped listening to the words. I kept my face under control as I felt the tender lumps on a rib. There were small crackling noises in her chest. I examined her everywhere. By the time I saw bruises high on her inner thighs, wings of worry were beating in my head. I typed a script for antibiotics as her mother pulled Jade's clothes back over her head. If I mentioned the lice as well, she might never come back. This should help her chest. She needs a spoonful 3 times a day. I'll need to check her again, so could you bring her back in 2 days? She nodded, staring at the script in her hand, and turned to go, pulling Jade after her quickly. I went to see Lynn, our practice nurse. She was in her room, humming quietly as she refilled her tray with bottles and syringes. When I told her about Jade, her brown eyes narrowed in concern. Jade's never been brought in for immunizations. She saw the locum nurse last summer, bad fall, grazes to her arms. Her neat hands flew over the keyboard. The father was here a few weeks ago as well, stitches in his hand, off his head with alcohol that afternoon. She glanced at me with a worried frown. I had the feeling he would lash out at any moment. I had encountered drunken men with open head wounds on Saturday nights in A&E while training. I remembered the obscene threats, the wildly aimed punches, while I sewed skin edges together with trembling fingers. So Jade's father was that kind of man. What do you make of the mum, then, Lynn?
Don't really know. Lynn leant towards the screen. Doesn't come in for her smears. It's on here that she saw Frank for depression last year and was prescribed citalopram, but she didn't come back for follow-up.
As she spoke, the pieces of the jigsaw began to slot together neatly. Thanks, Lynn. Any chance that you could, say, contact the mother about the immunizations?
And use it as a chance to visit? Course I will.
I rang the social worker, left a message. Tracking down the school nurse took longer. It wasn't the day for her drop-in clinic, but the school gave me her work mobile. She picked it up on the second try.
Jade Price? Yeah, I know Jade. Quiet little thing, not a happy child.
Why's that?
She gets left out. The other kids treat her like a leper.
The raspy voice wanted to gossip. I kept it brief. Does she get into fights? Her mum said,
like I said, the kids don't go near her. Too quiet. The nits don't help. Her dad fetches her from school sometimes, drunk as a lord, full of temper.
Another piece of the jigsaw clicked into place. The community paediatrician was out. I'd try later. As the senior partner, Frank would need to be told, but it would have to wait until tomorrow now. I was running late. The patients would be waiting with pursed lips, checking their watches. The beating wings of worry had gone, leaving a feather edge of panic. When my mobile phone vibrated in my pocket, I took it out and gave it a fleeting glance. Ed. I'd have to remind the children not to phone me here. There was never time to talk to them. I called the next patient in. Nigel Arkwright, a 40-year-old insurance broker, pushed his insurer's medical report across the desk at me.
Now on about how I've got blood pressure, he grinned.
As I wrapped the cuff round his curdy white upper arm, his thick fingers tapped the table. They looked like shiny pink sausages. The cheap kind with thin skin that split open with one touch of the knife. His blood pressure was high, but not dangerously so. He took the lifestyle booklet and blood test forms, then left to make a follow-up appointment, muttering to himself. The air in my little room seemed used up. I was grateful when Joe, our receptionist, brought me a cup of tea between patients. She wore her fair hair piled high on her head, but by this time of day, little strands were straggling loose. She set the white china cup gently down in a space on the desk between notes. As I took the first sips, I looked at the framed photographs on the wall. I hadn't changed any of them for a long time. There was one of Naomi at 5,
smiling so broadly her eyes had disappeared, tightly holding Bertie, then a new puppy. The boys were leaning in, half-hidden, grinning down at her. There was another from a party the previous New Year's Eve. Ted's arm was round us all. He must have said something funny because we were all laughing. Except Naomi. She was staring at the camera so intently she seemed to scowl. I pulled my attention back and called the next patient in. The dark afternoon eased into evening. Patient followed patient in a steady rhythm, and for a while I felt I was winning. Then Jo put her head round the door, her eyes wide with worry. Little Tom had just been brought in with an asthma attack. His mother, a pretty teenager with dreadlocks, was silent with fear. Tom was sweating, his skin tugged in between his ribs, the wheeze ominously quiet. I switched into automatic mode, and soon he was breathing in Ventolin bubbled with oxygen through a pediatric mask, too tired to resist. His head began to loll, and he slept deeply. The ambulance arrived soon afterwards to take them both to hospital, so he could be stabilized overnight. The room was quiet after they had left. My stethoscope lay on top of tattered envelopes with notes spilling out. Blood forms were jumbled together, and a wooden tongue depressor was on the floor. The beige surface of the tea was ringed with a milky white circle. I did all the end-of-surgery things, tidied notes and recorded letters on the dictaphone to the paediatrician and social workers. No visits. Jo left for home, her goodbyes echoing in the empty waiting room. I made a list of things to do in the morning and stuck it on the black face of the computer. The street was empty. Orange lights shimmered in the oily puddles. The pine furniture shop was shuttered, and faint noise.